I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The Maryland Court of Special Appeals today ordered a delay in the trial of Officer Cesar Goodson, the driver of the police van that transported Freddie Gray. WIPR reporter Kenny Burns has the latest at noon. Then the University of Maryland Shock Trauma Center is the busiest in the nation, treating more than 8,000 patients a year. We'll look at a new Discovery Life Channel series documenting the life-saving work of shock trauma. We'll speak to doctors Brandon Bruns and Jay Meniker about the golden hour, the narrow window of time physicians have to preserve a patient's chance of survival, as well as the emotional toll of treating critically injured people. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you are with us. Car accidents, shootings, falls, frostbite, just a sample of the types of injuries that show up at the University of Maryland's R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center. Shock trauma is the designated trauma hospital in Maryland, treating the most severely injured and critically ill patients from across the state. It is also the highest volume trauma center in the United States, treating approximately 8,000 patients a year. Of them, about 96% survive their injuries. Today, we get to take a behind the scenes look at the new Discovery Life docuseries, Shock Trauma, Edge of Life, which profiles the life-saving work of doctors, nurses, surgeons, and technicians at Shock Trauma. But first, the news of the day. We want to check in with WIPR reporter Kenneth Burns, who's been covering the trials of the officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Kenny, what's the latest?
Well, the latest is the trial of Officer Cesar Goodson, which we thought would start today. It's not, because the Court of Special Appeals, they issued an order this morning putting a halt to the proceedings. So effectively, the Goodson trial has been delayed as they try to decide whether or not Officer William Porter will be forced to testify in the upcoming trial.
Officer William Porter, of course, was tried on less serious charges than Officer Goodson is facing. But there was a hung jury in Officer Porter's trial. And so Judge Williams, who's handling the circuit court judge, who is in charge of all the trials, had ordered that Officer Porter should testify for the prosecution, where the prosecution could call him to testify.
Correct. There was a subpoena, which meant that Officer Porter had to show up during the trial if called. And then there was the order compelling him to testify under grant of immunity. And that's where you really start getting to the more complicated matter that has never happened before. Porter is essentially a star witness, and he has to testify under grant of immunity. His lawyers, Gary Proctor and Joe Murtha, they're arguing that because he will have to testify, he will not have Fifth Amendment privileges. He could possibly open himself up to perjury based on testimony for the last trial. The state, and it should be noted, and the Baltimore Sun, I believe, had this as well, the Attorney General's office, they handle appeals of this magnitude on behalf of prosecutors. They argued that whatever Porter testifies during the Goodson trial or even the White trial, Sergeant Alicia White, who also faces less serious charges than Officer Goodson, that can't be held against them, even at the in Porter's new trial later this year. June is his next scheduled trial date. With that said, the Court of Special Appeals, they'll have to decide whether or not Porter could be forced to testify. And keep in mind, he has two unique hats here. He's not only a co-defendant, he's not only a star witness, he's also a co-defendant.
A co-defendant who has so far there's been a hung jury. There hasn't been a decision by a jury on the charges against Porter. So do we have any sense of how long this will be? How long it will be until the Court of Special Appeals makes a ruling?
I'm sorry. We talked with Warren Alperstein, the former city prosecutor who has been observing the trial. He doesn't have any part in it, and he said it could take weeks or months to settle this matter. There's no word on how soon the Court of Special Appeals will handle will make a decision. The question is, will the Court of Appeals, which is the state's highest court, will they simply take over the matter to kind of speed up the timeline?
Oh, and when would we find out about that?
Again, no word.
It could be anything.
It could be any time.
And I'm about to ask you something else, which you probably can't answer, because remind our listeners that all the lawyers involved are under a gag order, so they're not giving the press any insight into scheduling or whatever. But is it possible that Judge Williams would reschedule so that the trials in which Porter was not going to be called to testify would continue while the Officer Goodson and Officer White trials would have to wait until this appeals matter is settled?
I would think, based on the first Porter trial and the last week or so, that was going to happen anyway. We saw the rescheduling of Sergeant Alicia White's trial to next month. We saw the rescheduling of Officer Garrett Miller's trial to March. So it's just the natural progression of things, where trials were going to be rescheduled anyway. Now, keep in mind, Goodson is the very next trial. That's now on hold. You still have Sergeant Alicia White also after this trial, also the trial where Porter is called.
Porter is a factor. So
those two trials, you might see the timeline rearranged a little bit.
And you're going to keep us up to date when it is.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, WIPO reporter Kenneth Burns. Just a reminder, you're listening to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, and our main topic today is that we are talking about what goes on at the University of Maryland R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center. A new Discovery Life series called Shock Trauma Edge of Life premiered earlier this month. Two episodes have come out. You can catch the next four on Friday nights on Discovery Life. The series was produced by Susan Hanna-Hadary, director of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Med School Maryland Productions. Susan Hadary works include King Gimp, winner of the 1999 Academy Award in the short documentary category. She worked on this series with longtime collaborator John Anglin, who is also a producer for Med School Maryland Productions, and both of them are with us. I want to welcome you both, Susan and John.
Thank you.
We're also joined by two medical professionals who were part of the series. Dr. Jay Menneker is attending physician at Shock Trauma Center and associate professor of surgery at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He joins us on the phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And with me in the studio is Dr. Brandon Bruns, attending surgeon at Shock Trauma and an assistant professor of surgery at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Susan, tell me how this series came to be.
Well, the series was basically a follow-up of a series I had done before called Critical Hour, but it was the Dean, E. Albert Reese, of the School of Medicine, who wanted us to pursue another series featuring the Doctors of Shock Trauma. And the Doctors of Shock Trauma are my absolute heroes. They are bigger heroes than anyone else in the world to me. They're quite amazing, amazing people. So I was really pleased when it came to fruition.
And what do you hope to accomplish with this series?
I mean, there's lots of things to accomplish. I think Baltimore and the country need heroes, and we need people who do positive things and change the world, make it a better place, and that's definitely the doctors and nurses of shock trauma. There's also prevention messages, although you don't quite see them as that, but I'm sure after anyone sees one of the programs, they'll never go outside without their gloves on in the cold weather.
We'll talk more about that later, yeah.
And the other thing is there's little pieces of information, medical information that come through. So it's educational in one sense, but it's also entertainment.
Dr. Jay Menneker, I understand you were a script advisor.
That's correct.
On this show. So were you in at the beginning when the decision was made to do this series?
I was asked to join once the decision was already made. I was actually involved in the production of The Critical Hour about 10 years ago. I did very similar work at that time. So I was very happy when they agreed to do the second program, and I was even very happy to be part of it again.
Why?
First of all, it gives me a little break from what I do every day, but I think it also allows me to help people see what we do every day. It allows me to help Susan and her team really portray us, to the public, to give them a sense, as I said, of what we do every day.
Dr. Bruns,
What went through your mind when you were, well, first of all, were you asked to be part of this, or did it's just that cameras showed up in the shock trauma center and there you were working, and so you were sort of instantly made part of a television series?
I was politely told that I would be part of the show, and you show up one day and there are cameras in the room, and you manipulate that situation and you still take care of your patient and try to proceed with
activities. Hard?
It's not, because there's already kind of, as my boss calls it, an organized chaos going on. So the presence of a single camera doesn't really alter your workflow too much. But it's a little bit different, but it doesn't really get in the way of patient care.
Presence of a single camera. John, was this shot mostly with a single camera?
Yeah. So I was basically the guy with a camera.
Oh, you were?
And acting as the field producer, one of two field producers. So, I mean, I do my best to make myself invisible, even though I'm tall and have a 15-pound camera on my shoulder. You know,
How tall are you?
Out of the way. Just under 6'5".
Okay, yeah.
He's sitting
down now, folks, so I couldn't remember, but I do remember when I met him a few minutes ago thinking, this guy's tall.
But we're, you know, we stay out of the way the best I can, you know, and Dr. Brunzis was great in terms of we need to regularly check in. You know, we can see things happening and kind of assume, you know, we understand what's happening, but we also need, you know, the medical professionals to tell us what's happening and kind of narrate for us as best, you know, so we mm-hmm. can kind of stitch together, you know, the sequence of care and, you know, also look ahead to what's next. And Brandon was great, you know, was always available. You know, I wasn't, you know, tapping him on the shoulder when he was in the middle of something, but when he broke away, you know, do you have, you know, a minute just to talk? And
yeah, you know, give me a sense of how close to real time that narration that I saw in the two episodes I've seen, you and other doctors explaining what just happened or what we're going to do next or why it's important and what we're going to do next. I'm sure it was different with different patients, but how close to the actual intervention with the patient were you taking time to look at a camera and say, this is what that just meant?
I think, as you just said, it's kind of dependent on the patient and the situation. Most of it was pretty close to real time, kind of giving the information.
Though we do come back. We do come back for follow up. John's also the editor on the series, and so it's pretty seamless. You don't know when we've come back at a different time to get further information from Dr. Bruns or Dr. Scalia, and they're really good about providing that extra information at another time too. So
it doesn't matter how good we are about, you know, capturing like every little nuance and everything. I mean, when you start to kind of lay out a story, there's always a little nuance or something you need to revisit or try to get a little better, clearer picture of what happened. So occasionally there are things that are, you know, shot a week or so or 2 weeks later.
I worked in television for about 15 years, and as you're explaining this to me, I'm thinking this is a situation where people wearing scrubs comes in really handy, because you don't have a sharp wardrobe difference. If you go back and talk to Dr. Menaker or Dr. Bruns on a different day, they're in shock trauma going to look pretty much the same.
Yeah, Dr. Bruns kindly did not change his glasses throughout the whole series, and we were very thankful for
were
that.
Were you supposed to? Were you walking around with impaired vision because you didn't get your glasses updated?
I thought about changing the frames once, but thought better of it. Didn't want to make Susan mad.
Dr. Menaker, one thing that struck me as I watched the episodes I've been able to watch so far was there's so many storylines going on at the same time, and I understand that is life in shock trauma, that you don't have the luxury of focusing just on one patient. There's a lot going on. But was there any thought when you were constructing a script that perhaps it would be more understandable to viewers if we saw somebody arrive in shock trauma, heard the diagnosis, saw what was done with that patient, understood the implications, et cetera? Or was it always thought that it was going to be, we meet this patient and then another and then another, and then we go back and find out what was happening to the second patient, then we go back and what happened to the first? Was that always the way the script was envisioned?
I believe that's the way it was envisioned. The goal is to really give the audience a sense of what we do every day. And real life is that, you know, Dr. Bruns, myself, Dr. Scalia, whoever is in the TRU is admitting multiple patients at the same time, is providing care for multiple patients at the same time. So that was always our vision, is to show it as real as possible. And that's the way we portrayed it. You know, that's real life. That's what we do.
We're going to take a short break here. That was Dr. J. I'm sorry, I'm losing track of Dr. J. Meniker from Maryland Shock Trauma. Also with us here in studio Dr. Brandon Bruns. Both of them are professors at the School of University of Maryland School of Medicine, and they work at Shock Trauma. And also here with me are John Anglim and Susan Hannah Haderi of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Med School Maryland Productions. They're the team behind the Discovery Life series called Shock Trauma, Edge of Life. When we come back, we're going to talk more with them, and we hope we'll talk with you. Have you or a family member been treated at the R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center? Do you work at Shock Trauma yourself? Does the documentary portray your experience accurately? If you've got questions for the series producers and the doctors who participated, give us a call. Our local number is 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to continue this conversation in just a minute. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Drs. Jay Meniker, who's on the phone with us, and Dr. Brandon Bruns, both of whom teach at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and work at the Shock Trauma Center. Also here in the studio with me are John Anglim and Susan Hannah Haderi of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Med School Maryland Productions. They are the team behind the Discovery Life series that's called Shock Trauma, Edge of Life, a behind-the-scenes look at the patients treated at Shock Trauma. By the way, one not terribly important question, but I am curious, since I was talking about scrubs. Who wears the pink scrubs and who wears the blue scrubs?
So everybody on the Shock Trauma side wears the pink scrubs, and people on the University of Maryland side tend to wear the blue scrubs. It's a convention that apparently came into place whenever Dr. Cowley was in charge back in the 60s and 70s.
Okay, so Shock Trauma has its own identity within the overall medical treatment that is going on in that part of Baltimore. This might be a good time, and Dr. Meniker, let me just ask you to start by tell us what we should know to understand this series, what we should know about the trauma system, the shock trauma system in Maryland, how it works.
This trauma system in Maryland is very unique in the sense of it's a state-run system. It's highly coordinated. There are very specific protocols on what patients should go to what trauma center or what specific hospital. So a lot of it takes people's opinions to some degree out of it. You know, so depending on people's severity of injury or mechanism or any vital signs in the field, they are designated to come to the trauma center, and that's somewhat unique across the country. But once they are in the hospital, it's a very, to some degree, as Dr. Brun said earlier, it's a little bit of an organized chaos. When you watch the show, you think people are sort of running around not knowing what they're doing. But everybody has their role in it. And then the only way that we can be successful is that everybody knows what to do at a given time and nobody's sort of getting each other's way. Although it may look like that, it's actually very, to some degree, choreographed.
And who choreographs it?
This is the way it's always been, from Dr. Cowley starting it to, Dr. Scalia and on. You know, everybody, when they start to work there, knows what their role is, and it's a little bit of a learning curve for people, but once they get in and they learn it, they realize why it needs to be that way, because otherwise things get missed, care isn't as it should be, and the patients suffer.
So, Susan and John, you are not medical people, but you are sort of embedded now at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. So, and you, Susan, had worked on a similar documentary 10 years ago as Dr. Meniker did. What struck you as you started spending time in shock trauma, in the shock trauma unit now? What were your first impressions of this organized chaos, and has it changed Susan, in the last
something
10
that
decade.
You don't really understand is that it's very quiet in the shock trauma center. Everyone, as Jay said, as Dr. Menaker says, knows exactly what they're doing, so no one's yelling out stuff at anyone else. It's kind of a hush. And so we're superimposing narration and commentary from doctors over this process. But it is so organized. It has always been organized from the very first time I came in there. The nurses stand in certain places. The doctors stand in certain places. Everyone has their own specific role and responsibilities. They don't have time for mistakes. It's really about finding the thing that's killing the patient first, as Dr. Scalia says, and everyone has their role in that mission. So not much has changed. It's just excellence continuing with better technology.
I've been there for 15 years, and as Susan said, it's been exactly the same since the day I walked in. The nurses are on one side of the bed, the physicians are another, you know, and everybody sort of has their role. And it is amazing how it hasn't changed. In, you know, so many things in medicine have changed over the last 15 years, and this is one of the few things that, you know, it works. There's really no reason to change it.
Yeah, if you've got a 96% rate of saving patients, I guess you have to say it works. John, is there a comment you want
to
make?
Yeah, I just, you know, this is talking about the weakness of what I do, is that the camera and the audio kind of skim the surface, and the storytelling we do just only skims the surface of what's going on. You know, we had coordinators working with us, Dina and Kathy Ross and Henry, and Kathy especially was very good, like, you know, after, you know, kind of something kind of cleared out, you know, after we could step back and, you know, get a drink of water or whatever, she would explain to us, you know, what they're doing to, you know, for a particular patient. Like, you know, this is all stuff that's ticking in their heads.
Yeah, there isn't much time to go to a medical book or even to the internet to say, what should we do here? This is something you doctors all know.
So in some ways, I wish I could, you know, put a mic inside their head, you know, and just, you know.
Careful what you wish for.
Just to kind of capture, you know, all the technical stuff that is going on in their heads while they're, you know, doing their operations.
And Brandon's just amazing. When you see him in action, Dr. Brun's in action, I mean, someone's life is in his hands, and he is methodical. Obviously, his years of training are all coming to focus on this particular patient, and he just does it. And it's like, to me, it's watching a hero in action. I just can't say enough of how just moving it is to see someone save someone's life.
This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kast, and we're talking about the R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. With us, Dr. Jay Menaker and Dr. Brandon. Dr. Jay Menaker's on the phone. Dr. Brandon Bruns here in the studio, both doctors at Shock Trauma and professors at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and the producers of the new series on Discovery Life Channel are John Anglim and Susan Hannah Haderi. You can be part of this conversation. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And let me go to Brendan in Easton, who has given us a call. Brendan, welcome to Midday.
Hi.
Hi. Your question?
It was more of a comment. My wife was in a near-fatal car accident here on the Eastern Shore over 2 years ago and was flown to shock trauma, and I just kind of wanted to give everybody just like a pat on the back, because you don't always get to go back and thank all the different people that really helped my wife and my family through a really hard time. And they're just the way they behave and calm, cool, collected under like total pressure. I agree that they're very much heroes, and I just wanted to say thanks, because they do an incredible job.
Thank you. We appreciate hearing that from people.
Thank you for the call, Brendan. Dale is calling us from Greenmount West. Dale, welcome to Midday.
Hey, good afternoon. I actually want to change my comment and actually let the public recognize how much of an innovator Dr. Crawley was in emergency medicine that was born out of his experience in Vietnam. I served in the Army as a medical officer, but I was a pencil pusher. I wasn't a professional. and I read his biography when I was in Officer Basic School. And the guy was a genius. He really was a genius, and I think part of the precision that's reflected in the trauma center now is because of some of his command that he bought in as a military officer. And I think that's one of the benefits that, although, you know, we don't want war, that is one of the benefits that has come out of war is his advances in trauma care. So I think Dr. Crawley should be recognized. And does anybody know what his first name really is?
What the R stands for? I noticed in the materials on the series, the R has no period after it. So I wonder whether it's like Harry S. Truman's S, which didn't stand for anything. Anybody know?
I don't know. I assume it's always R, because as you said, there is no period after it.
Thank you. Thank you, Dale. I appreciate your call. We've mentioned a few times Dr. Thomas Scalia. We haven't actually said out loud that he is the physician in chief at Shock Trauma. And I was struck by something that I read that he said, quote, "No one gets up in the morning expecting to end up as a patient in shock trauma. Our team is committed to giving every person a second chance." It struck me because in this day, we talk so much of healthcare is focused on dealing with chronic diseases that you do know when you wake up in the morning, I got to deal with my diabetes or I have to deal with, you know, whatever. How does that, Dr. Burns, how does that affect the patients, the surprise factor?
I mean, I think that's the emotional part of what we do, because you wake up in the morning and everything's normal, and then 2 hours later you can have a spinal cord injury, you can have a liver injury, you can be bleeding to death from a splenic injury, and that's really the emotional and the challenging part of our job, and it's the challenging part of communicating with the patient and also with the patient's families, because they expect, you know, they thought everything was going to be normal during the day, and then all of a sudden it's not. It's a life-changing day. And that's really the challenging part of the job.
I'm going to turn to my producer, because I have walked into here in the studio without bringing notes on the various clips that we had pulled. And it seemed to me that there was a clip from Shock Trauma that is exactly from the series Edge of Life, which is exactly relevant. And our esteemed director, Luke, is nodding at me, so he's going to play it.
Yeah, I'd prefer to get this kid here quickly. If we could get him up by air, that would be great.
The first 60 minutes after traumatic injury are considered the most critical. With every minute that passes, the chance of irreversible damage increases.
Yeah, the golden hour starts at the time of impact. And if you burn most of it getting the kid here, that's not good.
If there's any problem, we will let you know.
So that was Dr. Thomas Scalia in the series. Shock Trauma, Edge of Life. Dr. Scalia talking about the golden hour. Dr. Menneker, tell us about the golden hour.
The golden hour, you know, sort of came from Dr. Cowley. It was really, you know, the thought that the first 60 minutes are the most critical time after injury to treat the patient most effectively. You know, so as Dr. Scalia said, if you spend most of that hour trying to get the patient to the hospital, you've lost a lot of valuable time. So that's why we try to get the patients here as quickly as possible, whether that's by ground or by air, to really allow us to intervene as quickly as we can, because, you know, we truly believe that those first 60 minutes are really sort of the crucial time period after injury.
Dr. Burns, give me an example of something that can only work an intervention that only works if you do it right away.
Traumatic brain injury, for example. If you have a severe trauma to the brain and you have bleeding within the brain, you really need to have treatment within at least 60 minutes. Is 30 minutes better than 60? Yes. Is 15 minutes better than 30? Yes. It's just the time.
This is because the brain is going to swell?
The blood fills the skull, which then causes the brain to swell, which can cause eventual herniation. So there are medical adjuncts that we use at the hospital to decrease pressure. There are surgical procedures that we can use. We avoid low blood pressure. We avoid hypoxia or low oxygen. And it's just that time is so critical, because time is brain, or time is potentially a person's life.
And Dr. Menneker, aside from the brain, and not that that's a small thing, is there another example you can give us of what can happen only if it's done early?
You know, if people are, you know, either injured in a car accident or shot and they're bleeding, you know, the faster that you can stop that bleeding, the better. You know, sometimes 60 minutes is all you need to take to bleed to death, and sometimes less, so that, you know, the quicker the patients get here, the quicker we can identify these life-threatening injuries and the quicker we can get them to the operating room and stop the bleeding. And so time really is of the essence in almost any injury that we're faced with.
I'm going to ask, take a call from Walter in Baltimore, who was treated at shock trauma 2 years ago. Walter, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to call to relay how what a magnificent job these doctors and nurses do. I was very, very close to death from carbon monoxide poisoning.
How did that happen?
Actually, it was a suicide attempt.
Oh.
And the doctors, I was flown there, and they literally saved my life. A few 30 minutes more, and I would have definitely be no longer here. So these doctors and these nurses did a wonderful, wonderful job. And what watching them or experiencing it gave me a new zest, a new zeal to live. And I just want to thank anyone associated with the shock trauma for what they have done for me personally.
So they saved your life in two ways, then.
Yes, they did.
They counteracted the carbon monoxide poisoning, but they also gave you a reason to keep living.
Yes, they did. Great. Yes. I saw the care and the attention they paid for someone that they did not even know. Although it being their job, it went past that. It went past the fact that it was their job. They were concerned about my life. And listening to you guys talk about the quiet chaos, I know what that is, a period where there's very little talking and a lot of action being done. They saved my life.
Walter, I really appreciate your calling. Thank you, and good luck.
Bye-bye.
Anybody want to comment on Walter's story? It kind of speaks for itself.
I just want to say, first of all, I'm glad you're doing well. And I want to say that even after the doctors and nurses, not after, but in conjunction with, there are people that you don't see that are also working to save your life, whether it be housekeeping, cleaning up a room, whether it be the OR techs, whether it be the people in the cafeteria. I mean, the whole building kind of focuses around care of the trauma patient. So we've talked a lot about the doctors and the nurses, but that hospital would not run without everybody else.
Yeah, I can't agree with Dr. Bruns anymore. You know, the people that work at shock trauma, you know, are everybody from, you know, as he said, from the physicians to whoever. Their entire focus is really to take care of the patient. And without any one person, none of this really would work as well as it does.
And I think it's also important to talk about the people that get the patient to shock trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we spent time with the state troopers. I've spent a lot of time with volunteer firefighters, professional firefighters, EMTs. Those people are every bit as, you know, important to what happens at shock trauma.
Because the shock trauma center is a statewide facility, because patients are brought there from all over the state, I think a lot of us tend to think of helicopters as the main mode of transport. Dr. Menneker or anybody else, do you happen to know what the proportion is of patients who show up by ambulance or some terrestrial method of getting there versus the helicopter?
I don't know the specific numbers, but most of the patients, I believe, actually come by ambulance and come by ground. I want to say about 30% are by air, but I don't know that for sure. But it is a large percentage, but most of the patients come by ground. And as John said, you know, being a statewide system and organized like that, they are just as key players is everybody else in the system, because they need to get those patients. First of all, they go sometimes into dangerous situations. They need to get the patients out as quickly as possible and provide the, you know, that initial care. And they're in contact with us, so, you know, together as a team, we're providing that care for the patients while they're in transport. But, you know, they're really the ones that are on the front line getting those patients out from the deadly situation and bringing them to us.
I hear what you're saying. I've got lots more questions. We do need to take another break. We're going to talk more about the University of Maryland Shock Trauma Center and the new series, Shock Trauma, Edge of Life. Have you seen this new series? Have you or a loved one been treated at Maryland Shock Trauma? Does the documentary capture the feelings of stress, anxiety, or perhaps even hope that you experienced while you were there? Give us a call. 410-662-8780 is our local number. We have a toll-free number, and that is 866-661-9309, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. This is Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Drs. Jay Menneker on the phone and Dr. Brandon Bruns here in studio. Both of them teach at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and they work at the R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center. And also with us here in the studio are Susan Hannah-Hadary and John Anglim of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Med School Maryland Productions. They're the team behind the Discovery Life series we're talking about. It's titled Shock Trauma, Edge of Life. And let me invite listeners to join us. We are at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. To wrap up a topic that we had raised, our producers checked, and R in R. Adams Cowley stood for Rufus, according to Wikipedia, and he did not like the name Rufus, and so that's why it was R. I'd like to hear another moment from this series. This is when one of the patients in the second episode, named Evan, a teenager whose all-terrain vehicle rolled over on him, I think a couple of times, as I recall, and we hear from shock trauma nurse Sue Ramsey.
When we get younger patients, it is often the worst, scariest thing that's ever happened to them. And also for that phone call that the parents get, that's every parent's nightmare, is to get a call from shock trauma. And our job is to make this the most comfortable experience that we can for them.
We're going to do a bunch of x-rays. We're going to do some CAT scans, just make sure there's no internal bleeding anywhere, okay? They will, yeah, because he was having pain with that left foot and the right leg, right? Okay. Okay, sweetie, they're going to come and do a bunch of x-rays.
I'm going to slide a heart plate under you, okay?
Vital signs look pretty good, but we have to worry if he has any broken bones or any internal bleeding. And has a lot of scalp and facial trauma. So we're going to x-ray him, do some CAT scans.
You can breathe.
Evan, you don't have to hesitate if you need anything, okay? So far, so good. Pain management's working, and his mom's at his bedside. Now we just need to give him a little bit of TLC because he's a little bit upset.
Okay. Mommy's right here, honey.
Many of us who work here have kids, so it's very easy to put ourselves in the position of, what if that was my child? And we can get teary just like the families do. It's important to kind of hold that together.
That was a clip from the Discovery Life Channel series, Shock Trauma, Edge of Life, which is airing on Friday nights these days. That sense of oh my gosh, this could be me, is that something, Dr. Bruns, that you all train for? I mean, it's part of medical school, I guess, in a case that any doctor feels some empathy. But
you train for it, but until you're actually talking to the family and giving them news or actually dealing with that one-on-one connection, no amount of training really prepares you, I think, for the just how emotional those moments can be.
So how do you hold it together, as Sue Ramsey said?
Well, you don't all the time, but most of the time you do. And, you know, you figure out healthy ways to relieve that stress. I try to go to the gym every once in a while, but it can be a pretty tough moment.
Sometimes the adrenaline of that kind of stress, let's say, I won't say that kind of stress, I haven't experienced exactly that. Sometimes adrenaline can help you do your job better, and sometimes it gets in the way of focusing and it delays decision making. How do you find it affects you?
I think for us, I guess I'm speaking for trauma surgeons everywhere, I think that adrenaline is really what drives you, and it drives you to focus and it gets you through the night. And I mean, I know whenever my adrenaline kicks up, I kind of hone in and I'm able to focus probably a little bit better. I don't feel like it gets in the way. I think it's kind of almost a necessity for me to get through an entire call.
Dr. Menneker, is adrenaline part of why you chose emergency medicine?
Yeah, you know, emergency medicine, trauma surgery are very similar. Obviously, I have, you know, gone more the track of the trauma surgical patient, although I am not a surgeon. But a lot of it is, you know, that adrenaline, Dr. Brunt said, you know, trying to figure out what is the life-threatening thing that's going to kill this patient soon and try to take care of it. And I agree with Dr. Brunt. I think the adrenaline
keeps us going. It sometimes actually makes us more focused, and it helps us actually do our job more effectively sometimes.
We have quite a few calls, including the widow of our Cowley, our Adam Cowley. Mrs. Roberta Cowley is on the phone for us. Welcome to the show, Mrs. Cowley.
Am I on?
Yes, you are. Welcome.
Hi. I first wanted to say that how grateful, totally grateful I am that Dr. Cowley was remembered and mentioned in this program. I was just shocked, but he did devote, he and his chief nurse, Elizabeth Scanlon, started the shock trauma unit on or around about 1960 after doing a lot of research with animals in the medical center. And it was originally called a death lab. And he had room, he was given a $100,000 grant by the U.S. Department of Transportation because they had an interest in it. But he had so much equipment in this room that he could only fit two patients. But he was demonized for years for this, and it was called the death lab. But
I'm having a hard time understanding why it had that, why people called it that.
Because all of the patients that were sent there were dead.
Okay.
They were dead or close to dead. He wanted them within 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, in a medical environment and in a hospital, there's a lot of politics, and I'm far, far out of it. So that was the terminology that was used, the death lab. And many times, other people in authority tried to close this unit because it was getting a lot of attention in the press and in the newspaper because some of the lives that it saved. All of the lives that it saved. But my real purpose for calling is to tell you, I mean, I am just so totally grateful that Dr. Cowley was given recognition for starting this because this was his baby. He did have a son shortly before he died, but this was his baby. He slept there every night. It was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He would sleep on the x-ray tables. The carpenters finally made him an old bench, but he worked there from that period until the almost 1990. But I really, really want to thank that gentleman who called in Dr. R. Adams Cowley. I mean, he was a great man, very affable, very generous. And he couldn't care less about money. All he wanted to do was knock the sock off debt.
Well, I think you can hear in this discussion and in watching the TV series that there are blessings on his name every day from people at Shock Trauma. Dr. Menneker or Dr. Bruns, anything you'd like to say?
There is not a person in the building who doesn't, you know, first of all, we walk in every day and we, the name of the building is the name of the building for a reason. There's not anybody in the building who doesn't remember, appreciate, and attribute, you know, everything that we have the ability to do to Dr. Cowley for starting this and having the vision that he had to, you know, the golden hour and in providing the care. And that is never going to go away.
Mrs. Cowley, thank you so much for calling us.
You would have loved him.
It's nice to hear from you. Thank you. I'd like to also take a call from Dr. Alex Pazaki. He used to be a physician. I may be mispronouncing your name. I'm sorry. Used to be a physician at Shock Trauma. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Sheila. It's correct, actually. It's Alexander Pazaki.
Pazaki.
Yes. Back in 2013, I was involved in a motorcycle accident caused internal injury and lacerated my liver, but apparently I had a massive hemangioma, which is a blood vessel tumor in your liver, that it was found, and that was the main part of my severe internal injury. And the point I was trying to make was that, you know, injury could happen to any of us, both as a healthcare provider as well as a patient. So I was so lucky that I had a trooper right behind me, and once my bike went down, I had only probably 4 or 5 minutes to communicate before I passed out and I started having massive seizure because of my internal blood loss. I told him that I used to work at Shock Trauma, and here is the number for my wife. I blanked out, and the only thing I remember was the blades of the helicopter. And 2 days later, after 4 operations, I had massive internal bleed. They could not stop it. They keep packing, and then eventually they had to pass a balloon above one of the major blood vessels that was causing the bleeding, and eventually stopped it, and then re-injured and started bleeding again and multiple surgeries. And I eventually got close to 40 units of blood transfused. Almost the entire my body volume was replaced. So any local hospital did not have enough blood in the blood bank to keep me alive. So the fact that we have such a wonderful group of surgeons, nurses, staff, and a facility in Maryland that we're able to save people's lives in a timely fashion is amazing.
I appreciate your calling, Dr. Pazoki. Does anyone want to respond to him? Susan?
I would just like to say this verifies all that we have documented in our series, the amazing life-saving capabilities of Shock Trauma. And we want to say how very grateful we are to Tom Scalia for allowing us to film this and prepare this tribute that we've made in these 6 episodes, and also to Karen Doyle, who is the vice president at Shock Trauma, who actually did the day-to-day facilitation to make sure that everything went smoothly. We are very, very grateful for this opportunity to give this to Maryland.
Just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask either the doctors, what do you see in Shock Trauma these days with the shooting, the increase in shooting that's going on in Baltimore? Are you seeing a lot more gunshot wounds?
You know, anecdotally, I would say that, yes, it seems that we're seeing more and more gun violence. I don't know the actual statistics, but, I mean, I know the statistics for the city as a whole last year, and we're not where we want to be at this point.
Of course not, but I'm just wondering how that affects the functioning of Shock Trauma.
You know, I mean, we take care of the patients as they come in. Again, like we've alluded to before, though, whenever you have to go and tell a family that their loved one has been the victim of gun violence and that they are now no longer with us, you can imagine that that's an exceedingly emotional moment for that family. And we are doing that all too commonly right now in 2016.
Well, I'm curious, and I don't mean to Dr. Menneker, to make you be full of statistics, but that incredibly impressive 90% survival rate, 96% survival rate that the shock trauma unit has had, is this surge in violence in Baltimore going to lower that? Are these gunshot wounds harder to save people from?
It may, but you know, we go to work every day. We do our job, and to some degree, we don't actually look at the statistics. You know, we're there to provide care for every single patient that comes in, regardless of why they're there or how they got there. The statistics are nice, but the statistics doesn't, you know, mean anything to the person that comes in with a gunshot wound to the chest and doesn't survive. So we don't really look at that. You know, we go to work every day, and we go to provide care for, as I said, every patient that comes in, and we don't care how they got there. Our job is to do the best we can and save their lives.
Well, congratulations on all of you for doing it so well, and congratulations to Susan and John for this interesting inside look. This series, Shock Trauma, Edge of Life, airs on Friday nights at 10 p.m. on Discovery Life. If people haven't seen it, can they catch up on past episodes?
They're putting them on YouTube.
Putting them on YouTube. Well, thanks all of you for being part of this hour, and thanks to our listeners who called in. I'm sorry, there were a couple listeners we didn't get to, and everybody we heard from was terrific. I'd also like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. It features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on weekends. On the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Sheila Cass. Tomorrow, Midday takes a look at environmental legislation planned for this coming session of the General Assembly, which starts this week. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org. or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.